Good morning, Judge. My name's Catherine Spicer. My attorney registration number is 31762. I'm a little bit nervous. I'm used to the trial courtroom. I represent Robert Ray. With the police of court, I have two issues I'd like to address this morning. I would like to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal, if that's acceptable.
Sure.
First of all, Your Honors, Mr. Ray is entitled to a hearing on his petition. With the contents of the petition and all of the facts contained in the record as a whole, there is more than enough facts, if you will, that if true, would entitle him to relief. And I think the Colorado case law on that is very clear. I've certainly cited it extensively throughout the opening brief and the reply brief. Attached to that, and sort of the gravamen of that, is the Gant versus Arizona issue, which everyone gets very excited about.
Before you get there, yes, you asked us to use or exercise heightened scrutiny in this case because this case has some relationship to a later death penalty case. But what does that mean? I mean, what are you actually asking us to do? If we do exercise heightened scrutiny, what do we do differently than we would ordinarily do?
Well, I think heightened scrutiny applies in two ways. First of all, I think when we're looking at counsel's conduct and counsel's decisions, which the court has to consider at the time the counsel made them, not now, and then the approach that the court takes, I think we have to look at it through a finer lens, if you will, than if this were just John Doe's Palpo case, because the penalty that's hanging in the balance is, should it happen, irreversible. And that finer lens, I think, requires us as counsel to go through everything with a very, very fine-tooth comb. And I think this court has the same obligation, the same as the trial court has the same obligation in the post-conviction hearings. I hope that answers your question. I mean, I realize heightened scrutiny is, all of the death penalty case law has these sort of nebulous terms that we throw around, but they're all centered on the fact that should Mr. Ray be executed, and then we discover that there were mistakes made or evidence that wasn't turned over, we've still lost him.
Ms. Spicer, let me ask you a question related to your first statement that Mr. Ray is entitled to a hearing. What is your response to the Attorney General's contention that based on the Dunlap case, that there can be no ineffective assistance in not filing a cert petition with the United States Supreme Court?
Well, Judge Tallman, I have two answers to that. One is, I'd like to remind the court, and I'm not sure if I made this utterly clear in my opening brief, Mr. Zweigel was retained. He was not court appointed. And so we don't know whether there was an implied duty to file a petition for cert or whether there was an express agreement that he would do so. We don't know what the agreement between the attorney and the client were. And that's an issue that a hearing is exactly the vehicle to flesh out. Secondly, and long before we even get to the point when Mr. Zweigel could have or perhaps should have filed a petition for cert to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I'll refer the court to, I think it's Appendix C in the opening brief. I put together a timeline between the Perez case and Mr. Ray's case. But if you just look at the right-hand column, the dates in Mr. Ray's case are very dispositive. Back on February 8, 2008, Mr. Zweigel filed the reply brief in Mr. Ray's direct appeal. Shortly after that, the Supreme Court granted cert in Gant. And then following that, Mr. Zweibel filed once the, well, he had oral argument, and then later when his, when the Court of Appeals denied his appeal, he filed a petition for cert to our Supreme Court. He cited State versus Gant in both of those briefs, but at no time did he update, he didn't shepherdize, basically, the first thing we learned in law school. He didn't tack on to his citation in his petition for cert. Wow, you guys, this has been granted cert by the U.S. Supreme Court. We need to stop and wait and see what they decide. Now, I agree with Judge Speer. How was Mr. Zweibel to know that the U.S. Supreme Court was going to reverse Belton? No one knew. But, and I was discussing this with a colleague this morning, we all talk about searches in criminal law, right? What are the two things that are searched most often? A person's body, well, without a warrant, a person's body and their automobile. And of the thousands of cases that petition the U.S. Supreme Court for cert every year, a very, very small handful are granted cert. And of that small handful, very, very few have to do with the criminal law. And when you get something that comes along that has to do with an automobile search, any practitioner, prosecutor, defense, we've all had a gazillion car search cases. If you've got a case on direct appeal that is factually similar, you stop. You shepherdize your case to begin with. You cite to the Colorado Supreme Court, hey, this is on cert to the U.S. Supreme Court. This is a big issue. The courts of appeal have been divided on this, so we all need to stop and wait and see what their decision is.
But I want to get back to Judge Taubman's question, because if there is no constitutional right to counsel on a cert petition to the U.S. Supreme Court, even if Mr. Ray had an agreement with his counsel to file a petition and that wasn't done, how does that implicate Mr. Ray's constitutional rights as opposed to the rights he had under any contract with his lawyer?
I think if I understand your question correctly, Judge Berger, I think this is where we bring heightened scrutiny in. I know what Dunlap says, and I do agree with Ms. Rohrbaugh and with Judge Speer. But we do have that hanging question of, you know, what the agreement between counsel and client was. And then I think that is where heightened scrutiny comes. This case is undeniably related to the capital case. The evidence that was seized from this car was introduced not only at the guilt phase in the capital case, but also, and in my mind, more importantly, in the penalty phase. There may have been, who knows, one juror who had this not been admitted, may have voted differently on the issue of death. And that's why I think you bring in heightened scrutiny, and you have to look at it very, very closely, and perhaps Dunlap is wrong. That's the state of the law now, but we all know the court often reverses itself. Well, maybe not often enough for some of us who practice on the defense bar, but the court does change direction sometimes. We're an evolving society, and we have evolving rules, and we have evolving approaches to problem solving. So I think in the context of a capital case, I'm reaching to say that he has a constitutional right to it, but I think when counsel knows that his case is factually so similar to a case that is pending before the U.S. Supreme Court, I think as an advocate and under the ABA guidelines, he has a duty to say, stop. There's no strategic reason ever to not want your client's case to be dismissed.
If we have to review under a standard of heightened scrutiny, does that require us to hold counsel to a higher level of competency?
I was anticipating this question. And under the ABA guidelines for the appointment of death penalty lawyers, I think he does have to be held to a higher standard. Any connected litigation, and I've cited it in my briefs, must be treated with the same care and concern and focus that the capital case itself does. And this case is a perfect example of that. This is evidence that the prosecution, you know, this was a huge part of their case, and they used it very wisely. But it shouldn't have been admitted because it was unconstitutionally seized under Gant. So I think, I hope I'm not straying from your question. I got a little bit lost, but I...
Ms. Spicer, just to remind you, you have a little under 5 minutes left. I know you said you wanted to reserve 7 minutes. You can go as long as you want, but you're using up your rebuttal time.
Oh, thank you. I wasn't paying attention to the clock. Does the court have any other questions at this point?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Judge.
May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Rorgoa, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. It's the people's position in this case that the standards that apply are those that apply to every defendant. Standards include the 35C standards, which are that the defendant must make allegations in his motion for post-conviction relief, which, if true, would entitle him to relief. He also must make allegations with regard to ineffective assistance of counsel with regard to both prongs that would entitle him to relief, both that counsel's performance was outside the wide range of reasonable professional assistance, and also that there's a reasonable probability that but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the outcome of the trial would have been different, leading to an unreliable verdict and an unjust result. When we look at the allegations in this case, they fail. In particular, if we look at claim one and the prejudice prong of Strickland, the defendant's allegations simply fail because the officers acted in good faith. I cited to this court the Fourth Circuit case of United States versus Baker, which is a similar situation where a defendant argued on appeal that had his counsel made a Gant claim, he would have benefited from Gant. And the Fourth Circuit said, yes, but you couldn't benefit from Gant under a Strickland prejudice standard because, in fact, Davis says that good faith applies.
Ms. Warbaugh, what is your response to Ms. Spicer's contention on that point? I mean, she basically argues, as I understand it, that based upon the Colorado Supreme Court's decision in People v. Perez, that Mr. Ray would indeed have benefited from the Gant decision if the Supreme Court had considered Mr. Ray's case before the United States Supreme Court ruled in Davis.
Your Honor, that's exactly the claim that was made by the defendant in Baker, that because of the chronology of his particular case, he would have benefited only from Gant. And the answer is, in assessing Strickland prejudice, we look at the law at the time the court is considering post-conviction claims. And the Baker court cites the United States Supreme Court case from 20 years earlier, from 1993, Lockhart versus Fretwell, and quotes Lockhart in saying, an analysis focusing solely on the near outcome without attention to whether the result of the proceeding was fundamentally unfair or unreliable is defective, for setting aside a conviction or sentence solely because the outcome would have been different but for counsel's error may grant the defendant a windfall to which the law does not entitle him. That is essentially what the defendant here is arguing for, a windfall that he is not entitled to under the law.
So your conclusion applies in this case, even if theoretically, if Mr. Zweigel had filed a cert petition and it had been granted and the case had been remanded, that Mr. Ray might in fact have benefited from the law between Perez and Davis. Is that clear or is that too complicated?
No, absolutely. As a factual matter, he is asserting that his case would have been decided at the time of Perez, and thus he would have benefited from Gant before the Davis decision was handed down. And my position is, based upon Baker and Baker's reliance on Lockhart versus Fretwell, that this historical anomaly means the defendant is trying to argue for an unjust windfall, because he fell into this historical situation. Perez himself got an unjust windfall. But when we're looking at Strickland prejudice, the defendant here is not entitled to an unjust windfall. And based on our knowledge of Davis, which explained that good faith does in fact apply to Gantt situations, the defendant here is not entitled to relief because the verdict is not unreliable or fundamentally unfair.
If we did apply heightened scrutiny here, as Mr. Ray requests us to do, does that change any of the arguments that you're making to us?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that there's any case law that heightened scrutiny applies to a non-death penalty case, even a related case. I mean, counsel has cited some ABA standards, but the only case law that was cited is the Johnson versus Mississippi case. And in that case, the court reversed a death penalty because one of the underlying cases, which was an aggravator, had been reversed. But I don't think it says anything about heightened scrutiny or the standards to be applied in a related case. So I don't think there's case law supporting that heightened scrutiny applies. In any event, I think that it's clear that even in death penalty cases, the same standards apply. And here, as I said, the defendant had the obligation to make allegations in his petition for post-conviction relief, which, if true, would entitle him to a hearing. He simply has that obligation, whether he's facing the death penalty or not. And similarly, as Judge Hawthorne's question indicated, I think the defendant is subject to the same Strickland standard. There is not a different standard, even for a death penalty defendant.
So the rule that you rely upon in United States versus Baker, that wouldn't be relaxed in any way if we did apply heightened scrutiny?
No. No, because what we know from the Supreme Court's ineffective assistance case law is that, in fact, unlike counsel's performance, which we do not view in hindsight, we do judging counsel's performance at the time, we do view prejudice in hindsight, and the defendant simply cannot establish prejudice despite his factual allegation that his case would have been a historical anomaly.
Ms. Rohrbaugh, what do you think that the term, or what is your understanding of the term heightened scrutiny in just in a direct appeal on a death penalty case? What would it require the court to do differently than it would otherwise do?
Your Honor, I'm not sure. I mean, as counsel said, it's sort of a vague, amorphous term. So I think heightened scrutiny implies that somehow the standards applied would be different. But I don't see how the standards would be different. I think the defendant still has the obligation, as I said, to allege facts, which, if true, would entitle him to relief. And if we assume his alleged facts, that he would fall into the category of Perez and benefit from a historic anomaly would be true, as I said, he still does not establish prejudice for Strickland purposes, because, in fact, prejudice is established with the view of hindsight from the time that the court determines the post-conviction claims.
So do you think that in both this case and in a direct appeal involving the death penalty, that the phrase heightened scrutiny is just semantic surplusage that we use because we're very concerned about the imposition of the death penalty?
That may be true. I think if we look at the term heightened scrutiny and say, what does it mean? It appears to imply that we're very, very careful with the case. But I think it's actually perhaps offensive to say that we give some people better justice than other people. I mean, I think a person convicted of a Class 6 conviction deserves the same justice as a person who is convicted of a Class 1 felony. I don't think that we should have, you know, better justice for some. So I agree that this term is bandied about when the death penalty is in play, but I'm not sure that it has any concrete meaning.
Well, one possibility is that for an unpreserved error in a death case, we would review for harmless error rather than plain error. That's a possibility. That's one possible difference.
That's a difference, but I think the Dunlap case says that plain error applies only to death penalty defendants as well as other defendants where the error has been unpreserved. So I think that that's a theory, but that's not the practice and hasn't been the practice in Colorado courts. So I think with regard to the defendant's first claim, then he absolutely has not established the second prong of Strickland, the prejudice prong. With regard to performance, if we look at the allegations in the petition itself, the allegations are that counsel had an obligation to file a petition in the United States Supreme Court. Dunlap says that it's not so. There's been an allegation today that this might have been a part of his contract with his lawyer, but that, I don't believe, was alleged in the petition for post-conviction relief. I mean, the court's determinations here...
If it had been alleged, would it have made a difference?
No, I don't think it would have made a difference, but I think in terms of what this court is evaluating, this court is limited to those things that were considered by the trial court in evaluating the motion for post-conviction relief. And I think that the it's been sort of a moving target here, that initially the claim was that appellate counsel was unaware of the Gantt litigation. And then that changed in the motion for reconsideration, saying he was unaware, but he didn't provide adequate advice. And today we're hearing another theory, which is that perhaps this was a part of the contract that was not fulfilled. But that's simply not an allegation that was made in the post-conviction motion. So it's not actually before this court, and it's not a part of the review of the trial court's order.
Well, that doesn't that turn on just how specific you have to be in terms of the allegations you make in the 35C motion?
Yeah, and you have to make specific allegations. For example, saying counsel has a duty to investigate and didn't properly investigate my case is not a specific enough allegation to entitle a defendant to relief. A defendant has to say what the investigation should have been, what would have been found out that would have led to admissible evidence at trial that would have made a difference. So saying my counsel had a duty to investigate is not specific enough. And as I said, the claim, as I understand it, in the 35C motion with regard to counsel's performance was counsel was unaware of Gantt and counsel should have been aware of Gantt and should have protected his client's interest by filing a petition in the U.S. Supreme Court. And it's my position that that does not constitute deficient performance under the Dunlap case, but moreover, as I've argued today, I think it simply cannot constitute deficient prejudice or resulting prejudice under the standards that we have for Strickland prejudice. If this court does not have questions regarding the other two issues on appeal, I'd stand on the briefs and ask you to affirm the trial court's order.
Thank you. Spicer, you have 4 minutes and 38 seconds remaining.
The court refers back to the motion for reconsideration. There was a letter from Mr. Zoybell to Mr. Ray attached to that, and I also attached it to my opening brief. And within that letter, if it's not convincing enough that counsel was very aware of State versus Gantt through his reply brief to this court and his petition for cert to the Colorado Supreme Court, it's very, very clear in that letter dated November 17th, 2008. He references the case. He does not name it by name or citation, but he gives this extensive advice to Mr. Ray, and yet the advice that he gives is incomplete and incorrect, because he basically is trying to tell his client that the case will remain on direct appeal if he, you know, files for federal habeas or if he files a 35C. And neither one of those is correct. Once the mandate issues from this court, his direct appeal is over and the judgment is final. So there's no way under either of those avenues that he could have benefited from Gantt. And that letter, if nothing else, I think that letter in and of itself entitles Mr. Ray to a hearing. It's a meaty letter. The court can take a look at it and
Why don't you think that the rule in People versus, or United States versus Baker requires us to affirm?
Because I think we need to look at the decisions that counsel was making at the time he was making, and I understand his robust argument, but that's not the state of the law. Well, Davis is the state of the law now. But when we go back to that timeline, I mean, we're looking through the lens of ineffective assistance of counsel. And I realize your argument is prejudice is decided as of today.
Do you agree with that?
I don't agree with that, Judge. And I agree with her. I think if this was John Doe on an F6, my argument would be the same. I don't agree that when counsel is aware enough to cite to two different high courts in our state about a case that percolated up this very difficult pipeline to the top of the country, but yet doesn't announce that, doesn't do what he's supposed to do as an advocate for his client, that we should hold that against the client. That's not fair, regardless of where the penalty ends up. That is not fair. And our Constitution is about fairness. So no, I disagree with Baker. And I'm very proud of my timeline, but I also think the timeline shows what happens in many, many 35Cs. You know, prosecutors hate to get these petitions come across their desk. And so there, you know, if there's an easy answer out there, which I think Davis was for Mr. Howard, the prosecutor, that's a simple way, neat way to tie it up and resolve it. Instead of digging through the analysis and putting together a timeline or your note cards or whatever you do to figure out what was going on at the time that Mr. Zweigel represented Robert Ray. And keep in mind, please, Robert Ray was sitting in the Colorado State Penitentiary at this time when this letter was sent to him. He was on 23-hour lockdown. He didn't have access to a law library. I mean, there's a lot of facts about that that could be presented at a hearing, but they're also common sense if you're in the criminal law world that I live in. I don't know where I am on my time.
You have 30 seconds left.
Well, I guess I'll just address really quickly. I don't think Mr. Perez received an unjust windfall. I think Mr. Perez's attorney was on the ball, and she saw that opinion come down, and she knew it was her job to protect her client. And that's what she did. And the state of the law at that time was Griffiths and Hampton in the state of Colorado, and she knew it.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue a written decision.